Good afternoon. I'm Susan McGinnis. You're listening to KUAC. We are running just about 12 minutes late on our show, Conversations, today. But we are here. I should let you know, for those of you who are in the radio audience and not having the great privilege of being here in the studio, that we're not in the studio. We're sitting in an office with a pass-around microphone because public radio once again lost its equipment. So this is a novel beginning to the program. For those of you who are opera buffs, yes, the opera will join us in just about 1 hour. We will begin it a few minutes late so that we can begin and run to the end of this program. Well, I am Susan McGinnis, your host for Conversations on KUAC-FM. I'm pleased to have with me six guests. And today, on Conversations, we turn to the first pages of a knotted and complicated puzzle. This puzzle, which will be the focus of a week-long series of special reports by both KUAC and by National Public Radio all week this week, is called The Prejudice Puzzle. Racism is a knot this country seems unable to unravel. It has a different face than it had in the 30s, in the 50s, and in the 60s, but new face, or old, it is a part of our national heritage and our daily lives. Today on Conversations, we open our week-long look at prejudice with the first of two programs on racism. Today, a panel of Fairbanksons, conversant in a very personal way with the vagaries of racism, join me to talk about the past and the present of racism as they see it. Next week, we'll return with a look to the future. I hope you'll stay tuned this afternoon and join us next week, too. Let me stop and introduce first my guests. Kathy Mosley is a chemistry teacher at Lathrop High School. Yvonne Ryans is the principal of Ryan Middle School. Waukee Charles, a third grade teacher at Hunter School. Beth Horikawa works for Monroe High School. She is an English teacher. Charles Moore is with us. He is the affirmative action officer for the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District. And Sam Dementoff is the executive director of the Fairbanks Native Association. Thank you all for joining me today. Even though we are in this situation with this microphone that will rove, if you feel like interrupting or stepping on someone's period, do it. I will get there very quickly. I want to open with two thoughts that came to me this morning, two memories. One was of someone high up in the Reagan administration, just before Reagan left office, saying something to the effect of that racism was no longer a dominant force in America, that we had economic problems, we had educational employment problems, we had problems among minorities as among the dominant culture with drug abuse and substance abuse, but that racism was no longer the driving force. The second one was more recent. In July, the Temple Beth Shalom in Anchorage was desecrated. Two young people, runaways, broke in, put swastikas on the walls, and wrote Nazi slogans. Tom Fink, a couple of days later, when he was at the temple, said that this was an aberration. The two young boys were just runaways. They were angry. They were frustrated, and they broke in and did this. But that racism did not exist in Anchorage. It wasn't a problem there. My sense is that I won't find agreement with either of those two opinions in this room, and I want to start with that. Have we dealt with racism in the United States? Who has a first thought? Kathy Mosley?
No, we haven't finished dealing with it. We started a few years ago, 25, 30 years ago, but we haven't finished with it. We still have a lot of negative reactions to people just because of their skin color. I see it every day. I don't know how to solve that problem. I don't know. But we need to work at it because the clock's ticking away.
Yvonne Ryans?
I think I agree with what Kathy said. We started to work on it, I think, in very small pieces. But since it's affective in many cases, and you can't get your hands on it, you can't grab it, you can't be objective in some cases in addressing it, it makes it even more difficult to work on. And it's kind of, I guess I described it as a fog, and I think that's what I think of. And a lot of things can happen in a fog. Negative things can happen, things you don't see. Fog rolls in and out at all different times. It can be thick, it can be ice fog, it can be just a number of things. And I think we've started, just barely scratched the surface.
So having, at least in terms of black-white relationships, having removed from our core lynchings as common, removed from our core segregation as common, we are less attuned to what is racism in our society in the 90s? Yes, no? Yvonne Ryans again?
I'm not sure we've removed either one of those things. Oh. It may not be a physical lynching that has taken place. There may be lynchings going on in other ways. I just don't think it's gone. I think they're there.
Sam Dementev, can I turn to you for a thought? Where do you think racism lies in the society as a whole?
Well, there's one thing that came to mind when you just started talking about racism is the thing that's taking place in the Middle East right now, the Middle East crisis that we see. And back when in the 70s, when we had the first oil crisis, the attitude and I guess the lack of understanding about the people, the Arab people and the people living in the Middle East area, the attitude of Americans in general was that the oil is there, and if they want to sell it, they sell it to the rest of the countries in the world. But the attitude here in the United States was an attitude of ignorance of who those people are and what they do and how they live. And I think today you see the different newscasts on the TV, and you see the newscasters talking about the situation we're in there, but they don't understand the people, the different types of people there. If you look at the state of Alaska, you see there's a number of different types of Native peoples that live here in Alaska, but no one cares to understand or try to learn about that. They just say, well, there's Alaska Natives, Eskimos, or Indian people, and not trying to understand that there is differences in the culture as far as Native people are concerned and how they deal with each other. So I think the point I'm trying to make is in the Middle East, we see them, when I say we, as Americans, we see them, we need the oil, the world needs the oil, and why do we have to contend with this, what's happening there, because the countries are doing what they are to each other. But we don't understand them. We don't understand what the Arab people live. We don't understand when they say a holy war. We think, well, gee, that's crazy. You know, it's no holy war. They're out there killing people. They propose to kill people. But we don't take the time to try to learn what they mean. So the point, I guess, I'm trying to make also is that we don't understand what those people live in, how they live, and we don't care. We'd rather just fight the war, get the oil, and the heck with them. So it's a lack of understanding, a lack of caring to understand, and then it's ignorance. You don't have any idea or concept and don't want to know about what the Arab people, and I say it myself, the Arab people, I don't even know what kind and different peoples there are there. But we should try to understand. Then you can look at the other different areas in the world, in Ireland, why that is taking place. And then you can just look at right here at home in the United States and in Alaska. But that's just an aspect that came to my mind when you started mm-hmm. talking. You know, this is something we can see today. And if you see the interviews, you see the Marines over there, and they're ready to fight. Fight, and they don't understand why they're there. You know, they say the president's our commander-in-chief, and we're just going to go in there and do this war if we have to, and they don't care or understand. Mm-hmm. And so they're kind of, I don't blame them, because they're young, they're there to do a job. And when I was in the Army, and we were told one thing in the military, is that, you know, you're the best equipped, best fighters, an army that can't be beaten. So when you get out there, I can see it in those young people out there, those young men. But the attitude mm-hmm. of how those people live in the area, you know, is something we have to try to stop and learn. Then we can understand something.
Do you think, and I'm going to, Waki, I think I'm going to address this to you so we can move around the room and introduce each of our guests to the listening audience. Going to Waki Charles now. taking what Sam said about not wanting to understand the other, whoever the other is, in an interview last week with a young Native Alaskan, 15-year-old, incredibly articulate child, she is part Eskimo and part Cherokee, and she has been downtown when tourists and also Fairbanksans have come up to her and looked closely at her bone structure, and then proceeded to identify her. Ah, you're Cherokee, or ah, you're Navajo, or whatever. And her response to that was twofold. One is, you've interrupted my privacy. You have come to me on the street and talked to me as if I'd invited you to talk to me. So one, you interrupted my privacy. But the other thing is, you identified me by what you perceive me to be, what you perceive me to be, instead of who I am. And I wondered, I guess I just wanted to reflect that to you and then to anyone else who wants to respond to it. It seems very similar to me to what Sam talks about when we identify the Arabs as exotic, other, enemy, and probably a little mad because of their concept of the holy war. What is your sense of the difference between what you are and who you are? And
my sense of what I am and who I am is, I think, I would tell everybody that it's to each his own. You are who you are. And one thing, being a classroom teacher, that's how I perceive my students. My classroom is, you come into the classroom, you're nobody but a third grader. And we're all here, and we're going to learn just as much as your neighbor, the person right next to you, is going to learn. You come into my classroom, we're going to deal with things that a third grader is going to do and forget about everything. I forget who I am. I come into the classroom, I become part of the third graders because I want to learn, I want to share, I want to live, I want to give just as much as they do. And I think establishing that right from the beginning, you can go somewhere. And I strongly believe that, you know, in order to make things happen, make things move forward in a positive perspective, you need to tell, you know, I mean, you need to share that with others and go from there. And I really do forget who I am, what my background is when I walk into the classroom and I'm inviting my kids every morning. It's a feeling like, I'm here for them, they're here for me, and we're going to do things together. And I have a diverse background of kids in my classroom. But you walk into room 28, and we're third graders.
Mm-hmm. This seems to me to be an ideal way to proceed, but I don't know whether it's the way that many proceed. Charles, what's your sense of how able we are to be colorblind? Charles Moore.
Well, before I deal with the term colorblindness, I'd like to go back to your initial questions about the past and have we really overcome racism in the country, and what have we done if we have to overcome racism. I think we have. I've seen the ups and downs of our progress to eradicate racism from our society. Having been born in the 40s, late 40s. I had personal experiences during the 60s and 50s that are still etched in my memory. So therefore, I can sort of look back and do a summary of what progress has been made. I think that to a certain extent, most people would hope that we have done great things to eradicate racism. In some quarters, we have. Overall, however, I think that we are pretty much in need of a lot of work, as Kathy mentioned and as Yvonne mentioned. We have taken several steps, in my estimation, backwards. The violence that occurred during the early 50s, when you talk about lynchings, et cetera, and the hurt and harm that is inflicted upon people of color, is still occurring. Some of us are not aware of that, but it is occurring. I try to stay in touch with the whole of America. And in the past two summers, I've had personal knowledge of violence that occurs throughout the country. I mean, it's in some respects, it's even worse than it was during the 60s. I carry the scars of the 60s, but I've also worked at trying to overcome that era, as Walker Charles just mentioned. It's difficult to do that. And for one thing, I think that for us to look at the term colorblindness, I don't think that we're there yet. I think that that's a term during the 80s that we heard quite a bit of, that we'd gotten to the point where we have a colorblind society. And to me, that is implying similar to the term of invisibility. In other words, if you're going to tell me that I'm invisible, then we have another problem. So I don't advocate that we are a colorblind society. I don't think that's what we should be advocating. We should be advocating the respect for individual differences, and the fact that a person happens to be by pigmentation, whatever they are. If they're white, they should be proud of that. And that the fact that they are, that they should be clear on that, that yes, I am and I exist. If you're black, you should be proud of that. If you're red, you should be proud of that. And I think that we need to do more in terms of dealing with diversity and respecting that diversity. But we've got a long, long way to go, in my estimation. The violence is still there. Racism is alive. It has not, in any way, form, or fashion, been eradicated. And you can't eradicate it by passing legislation. That's the one definite fact that I grew to understand, having been a part of the 60s and the legislation that was passed. It does some good, but you don't eradicate racism through legislation.
Charles Moore talking to us. Beth Orakawa, can I just ask you for your thoughts on the conversation that's gone on thus far? I'd like to bring you in this conversation as well.
There's a couple things I'd like to say. I think that the racism in this country is more insidious than it's ever been, because particularly during the Reagan administration, it was full of platitudes and lip service about how racism didn't exist, everything's okay in America. It was everything that white middle-class America wanted to hear. We love platitudes. It makes us feel good. It helps us alleviate our guilt. And what happens is that all of the real nastiness gets buried under nice words, and it becomes more insidious. We may not be as overt. We may not use those nasty words. We may not be as nasty physically or verbally to the people of color. And that's more dangerous, because then we can deny it's there. And I think that America has become very adept at just very glib. We're real good at the words and the outward shows, the proper show of how not to be racist, but deep inside and in dark corners, it's there and just fermenting. And that's dangerous, because I was a college student back in 1970 when everything was happening, and I went to the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and where all hell broke loose. And I see many of the same things that created that happening now, and I think that it's going to happen again if something's not done. I would also like to point out the lynching thing that you mentioned interested me, because when was it? It was 3 or 4 years ago that the son, and I don't remember his name, but I know her name was Edna Mae Donald. She was the mother of a young man who was lynched in Mississippi by several members of the Ku Klux Klan. The result of that was that the Ku Klux Klan, and I think it was Mississippi, I could be wrong. Was it Mobile? Okay. They lost a lot of their holdings legally. That the Ku Klux Klan in that area was decimated. But the bottom line was, this young black man was lynched in 1985 or whenever it was. He was hung to a tree, and I believe his throat was slit. And that's ugly. And the New York Times Sunday paper last week had an article about a new rash of anti-Semitic incidents at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. I keep up on that because that's my alma mater. Hideous things happening, swastikas painted on fraternities and sororities in Madison. It's just happening all over again. It's there. It's real. We love to give lip service to it, but sorry, I don't see improvements. I really don't. Not in 20 years. I see a lot of lip service, but not a lot of major improvements.
Let me stop. Thank you, Beth. This is Beth Horikawa, who is an English teacher at Monroe High School. I want to stop for those of you who tuned in late or those who are having trouble with the scorecard here at your home. To reintroduce you to our guests. Waukee Charles is with us today. He is a third grade teacher at Hunter School. Hunter School is implementing this year a program called Excellence in Indian Education. We may get to that as time goes on. Actually, most of the schools and programs represented here are implementing programs or working on programs that will assist in this effort. Yvonne Ryans is the principal of Ryan Middle School. She has been an educator in Fairbanks for 10 years. Kathy Mosley is with us. She is a chemistry teacher at Lathrop. Charles Moore is the affirmative action officer for the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District. And Sam Dementov, the executive director of the Fairbanks Native Association. Kathy, I think I want to go back to you, Kathy Mosley, for a minute to follow up on what Beth had to say. Your sense in interviews with Ann Thornton last week, or at least your expressed sense, was that the world outside is getting more violent from your perspective, more angry. Am I right in that's your sense? And if you could speak to that, and then I want you or somebody to bring it to Fairbanks and say what you think about the situation in our hometown. Kathy Mosley.
Well, this is 1 year and a few days after the Bensonhurst murder and the trial there with the outcome. I think with the lynching, you know, all of this stuff is continuously building up and building up. Maybe 30 years ago we didn't hear about it quite so much, you know, and finally it was brought out by the great use of the media. Whether the media plays more on it now or not, it's kind of like that situation where the man killed ended up killing his wife in the car in a black area, mm-hmm. and that kind of thing. Oh, must have been a black man. They were in a black mm-hmm. area. Must have been. You know, when all of the facts led to the husband doing it. You know, so we jump at conclusions.
And we believed that for quite a while. We believed it must be a black man for quite a while.
On that situation.
To the point that, you know, someone was arrested and you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, the country likes to believe easy solutions, just as Beth was saying with lip service. We like to believe those kinds of things. You know, you can see things building up and building up. You know, things are going to happen. You know, we had a 25 years, supposedly, with, you know, the civil rights legislation. You know, and then it was all coming up again for recertification or you know, to be repassed in the legislature. And we've lost a lot of rights there. We didn't make it in 25 years, and now we're going to start over again. You know, we're going to have to go through those struggles again. And I don't think this time it's going to be, I mean, it wasn't easy the first time, but this time it's not going to be as easy as that. It's going to be a lot more violent and a lot more people are going to get hurt. You know,
the level of anger is higher. Level of ignorance may be higher. Both.
I think people have covered it up. You know, it's nice to be on. You can be nice on the outside, with all of this, and you really don't know your inner self. It's much easier to deal with somebody who is overt racist. You know, mm-hmm. I don't like you because what color you are. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can talk to that person, and reason with them. The person you cannot reason with is, oh, I like you. Some of my best friends are. Yeah. You see, we all know it. We all know it, don't we? And that's the person you've got to watch, you know, because they're the ones you don't know what's going to happen to. You know, they're the ones you don't know how they're going to react, because is it their mind that's reacting, you know, this rational being that they like to portray, or is it that inner self that comes out when the situation calls for it, you know, when they're pushed?
Sam Dementov, could I come back to you just for your thoughts on this end of the discussion? No, you can't say no, Sam.
Well, I don't know how to follow along on the same line, but the thoughts were coming to my mind when you were just, you know, going through the conversations, was that If you look back at whenever people come into a new area, and, you know, whenever there's, like the development of the United States, or the founding of the United States, the Columbus came over and discovered America, seeing the native people or the Indian people living on the land, there was a different, you know, I think, that, I don't know exactly how it went there, but they helped him live in the New World. But I think there was, at that point, I think there probably was a development of racism at that point, was who are all these people, who are all these, and they were uncivilized people. The reports going back to their countries were that they were uncivilized people, savages, you know, running around without any clothes on, which is something that they never took the time to try to understand how these people have lived for hundreds or thousands of years on this land, who had a beautiful culture and were able to successfully live in harmony with nature, the animals, and keep the United States land area the way it was for hundreds or thousands of years. And the way I see it now is within the last 200 years of the civilized United States, we see all kinds of different things taking place in the United States. There's pollution. Well, you just named the whole different things that are, you know, it's not overpopulation, but the setting aside of land for use by the people. But the whole point is, I'm trying to make, is the people that lived there originally, you know, they were sensitive, they were cultured, they knew what they were doing, and but no one took the time to really understand them. Today, you still see that there are Indian people that, and if you just look at their customs, you can see how a person that did not take the time to find out what these customs meant. And for example, is you know, the buffalo that were numerous throughout the plains area, the Indian people would go along and they'd pick up the buffalo chips, the droppings of the buffalo, and use those. They'd use them for wood. I mean, not for wood, but for fire. Now, if the people come along and see these Indian people out there picking up these buffalo chips, you know, they say, well, geez, this is great. You know, here's some people out there. And they go along and they report back and say, well, they, you know, all they do is go around and pick up these buffalo chips, and they don't understand what's going on. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, and then they make names. There's names that evolve about it, around it, and there's no sensitivity to the people that live there. So I think that the way we have to deal with it in Fairbanks today or in the world today is to look at people as people or as human beings. And I know this may sound idealistic, but you know, if you look at the colors of all the different peoples in the world, you know, we make up a combination of a variety of colors, but together we're human beings trying to live on this earth. And we need to develop some kind of a sensitivity, understanding, and an education system that would help us to understand each other. And I think that if we could do that, but I know that we're human beings that also have human nature. And human nature, if we look at the way it's developed in each one of us, there are things that are in us. Greed, there's selfishness, and other things that are traits that are there that come out. And when those things come out, then you can see racism come into your life, and it affects not only you but other people. So I think you know, ignorance of native peoples or peoples of the world, and not caring, and then being sensitive towards how they live and how they live their lives and how what their culture believes in. Some of it is spiritual. The native peoples, Indian peoples of the world, were real spiritual, and the way they'd stand out and look at the sun and give homage to the sun, and the report or the view would be, well, they're sun worshipers. They weren't sun worshipers. They just gave spirit to the and strength to the sun and understanding of the sun, because it provided warmth for the day to live, and it provided food and everything and for the plants and animals. So of course there was a real a tribute given to the sun in that regard, but it doesn't make a person a sun worshiper, you know, a person that is a paganistic person. So there's a misunderstanding there. So that's just a couple of the views I have.
Thanks, Sam. Sam Dementev. I want to take a look, turn for a moment to impact on young people. We are in this room, adults. We've survived our childhood and our youth, and I assume each of us in one way or the other is working on or has worked on a sense of self, that esteem, which Sam has talked about in the last week with our interviewers from KUAC, that lets you stand in the world no matter what anyone else thinks about you or says about you. What is your sense, and I'll just ask someone to be responsive here, of how you dealt with dealing with racism in your life, either your childhood or your adult life? And what do you think children are having to fight in 1990? Can I have a witness here anywhere? Charles Moore?
Well, I remember as a young lad, if I can start with that point.
I think in 1846.
Several things that stood out, and I was very inquisitive. I wondered why some things were the way they happened to be. I grew up in Mobile County in Alabama, and was basically just curious about how things were set up. You know, I would visit my mother, who worked in a kitchen. She was a cook. It was obvious to me that I could not enter the front door, that I had to enter the rear door that had in the back makeshift eating facilities for blacks. And I would always wonder, why couldn't I come through the front door? And in fact, at about 10 or 11, she worked for many years as a cook. I could see through the kitchen and view the white people eating, and I wondered. In fact, a few times I would slip out, you know, she'd pull me back, but I'd go outside. I'd go out of the kitchen. And I grew up in that environment, you know, didn't have a lot of interaction with kids my age that grew up in my community until around the 10th, 11th grade. And I met some guys that we worked in fields together. And we formed some friendships that way, you know, by working together. As I entered my senior year in college, I ran into a couple of these guys who were students at Auburn University. At that time, I was attending Alabama State University. And, of course, they recognized who I was. At that time, I had come through quite a bit during the mid-60s as a student leader at Alabama State University, leading demonstrations if necessary to try to combat injustice. But the key to my understanding of self, and I guess it's difficult to explain the conflict between who you think you are and what's being communicated to you in terms of what you are by the outer world. So I had to deal with my self-consciousness. In order to do that, I chose to major in science. My one and only reason, I hate to say this, but for doing that at that particular time was to find some answers to some questions.
What, are we different?
Well,
you were looking biologically.
I wondered what was different about us, what made a white man better, and in the South that was the clear a message that was articulated during my young upbringing, my life. It was as if you were black, you were not second or third. You didn't even rate. You know, you were just there. And some people didn't recognize that. So through science and studying systems, it was something I had to do. I had to find the answers. And through knowledge, I guess I was able to define who I was. And that's, you know, and I think what happens to a lot of black males is that there's that conflict. And some of that conflict pushes other buttons. Right now, for an example, in our country, we have, I would say, around 609,000 black men between the age of 18 and 26 in our prisons. And some of those young men are in there because they have not found any goodness in life, and they have not found anything that really defines who they are. So in searching for that, a lot of the things are brought into the picture. And there's a feeling of I must strike out against the world because of the way I feel about me, okay, so if I could put it that way. But I found a way. I found the answers through education and trying to define for me who I was, not to let anyone else define who I was, who I am, you know. And I've put myself in certain categories, and the first of which is that I'm a human being. No matter what you may call me, the first thing is that I'm a human being. And then I guess maybe fourth on the list, let's go through it. I'm a human being first. I'm a black male second. I'm an American third. But I belong to the human race first. That's it.
Thanks, Charles Moore. Yvonne Ryans, any difference for a black woman generally than for a black man in listening to Charles speak?
And we don't have enough time.
Well, she said we don't have enough time. I don't know where the microphone is to the listeners. Start. Come back.
I think there are differences, gender differences and philosophies. And it goes back to, I think, how our parents or whoever raises us, socializes us to be a person of color. My upbringing is different from Mr. Moore's in that I was brought up in the North. So what I saw there was a lot different than what a lot of people see in the South. And if some people finally call the South the old country, like many white folks call Europe the old country, so you can call the South the old, our quote, old country for what goes on. But I think that the differences have a history from the initial bringing over from Africa of the women that came or the females that came and what they endured and what happened to them. So I think there may be, yes, the same anger and the same hostility to strike out to find out who I am, and where do I fit, what category do I fit in. But I think it goes back to how the extended family, as it's termed to be, I never knew it was extended family, it was just a family, and how I was raised to look at things. But when I look at the differences, I celebrate the differences. And I think in nature, as Sam said, the differences are appreciated. Not every flower is yellow. Well, we have some mixed colors and we have hybrids and we have lots of things that go on. So I think the differences need to be celebrated and to be appreciated and learned and valued for being different and not forced to be something else. Okay, that's one thing I think of when you asked earlier about the children, what happens to children. And when I think about that, I think of in Alaska that people of color, only one group is recognized as people of color, Alaska Native, that there is no recognition that there are other cultures here and that we play an important role in the state of Alaska, in the history of the state of Alaska. When you take that into classroom situations, you find in many elementary situations that the kids make it along fine. Then changes take place once they hit sixth grade and start going up through, I say, grade 12. For my own self, I can think of being invited to go to white friends' house, and that was okay. But when I was taught to reciprocate, they could not come to my house. Okay, so you take that into a classroom and you may pair up some students. Say you pair up a black and white student to work on a project, or a Hispanic, or Alaska Native, but two different cultures paired up, and the assignment gets done by one but not the other? You know, is there a penalty for that child? Usually so. But has the teacher taken time to find out, was that a good pairing to begin with? If I happen to come from a family that has certain racist philosophies, and now I have a partner that I have to work with that is against that particular philosophy, what have you done to that student? What have you taught that student? I think that children need to be looked at, and teachers need to be have their awareness or their consciousness raised that what you do in the classroom may be good intentioned, but what are the other outcomes of it? And as they get older, the society changes, and different rules come into play. And the more complex the society, the more complex the roles and the status and the roles. And I think schools and stratify kids not only economically, but ethnically, by gender. So there is a large stratification that takes place in schools. So the differences between African American or Black or people of color, male and female, are similar than they are for the culture on the whole. There are differences in those cultures too. I think what happens when the racial part or the ethnic part enters is that it becomes bigger because you can see it, or it's a more sensitive issue when you can see it.
Beth Harakawa.
I want to pick up on a couple of things Yvonne was saying, and get back to this issue we touched on earlier about the other and denial of the other. When I think of students in particular, I'm white, and I was raised to have a very strong sense of self just because I was raised by amazing parents. My husband is Japanese American, who was born and raised in Hawaii. The Japanese Americans in Hawaii have a very strong sense of self. Their culture is very strong. He has a wonderful sense of who he is as a Japanese American. His cultural background is very deep and very strong. We're both very lucky. What happens to a lot of students, a lot of young people in this country, is when they enter, when they're aware of society, and particularly when they enter the educational system, there is a denial in the educational system, in society, of their cultural and ethnic background just by the sin of omission. As a woman, I'm a feminist, and one of my concerns as a woman is the denial of the importance of women in America, in literature in particular. And so I'm on this quest to make sure that the voice of women in America is heard, that our literature is heard. And that's an issue for me. It's not a race issue, but it's a gender issue, and it's important. This issue of woman is important in America. A lot of my students who are African American, for example, and Native American, particularly Native Alaskan, when we are studying things, they're not aware that there's a real omission of their cultural and racial heritage. They need to be told, and if the teacher, if the adults around them aren't telling them there's an omission, they don't even know it's omitted. They just know that somehow they are being denied their uniqueness by the sin of omission. We need to include in our society and in our educational system awareness of the literatures and the cultures of these different ethnic backgrounds. I think we're all guilty of the sin of omission, which denies the otherness of a person, which is devastating to a young person. I have my otherness. My parents gave that to me. My cultural milieu gave that to me. My husband has his otherness. He was raised in a real strong cultural background, but we deny that to many of our kids, and I think it's horrendous.
And I don't mean to interrupt, but it seems to me that it's very difficult. For example, so many books are written from a white male perspective. Mm-hmm. I'm a white person, but I'm not a male. It's hard for me to keep translating so that I'm included in the text. It's hard to keep translating the he's.
See, what happens is that we're taught not to translate, and we feel alienated.
Yeah.
And alienation is a constant theme anyhow in 20th century American literature. Mm-hmm. And it's just, to me, the pervasive theme today in America, in Fairbanks, is alienation. So many of my students are alienated for a variety of reasons. The white females are alienated. The young white males are alienated. Everybody's alienated, and everybody pretends it's okay, and we just keep doing the same things we've always done. And I try as much as I can to make that alienation less. But that's a perfect point you make. You're reading this stuff, and you don't even know how to translate. You've never been taught.
Where do I fit in it? I was reading the other day something about teenagers, and the teenagers constantly ask, where do I fit? Where's my place? Who am I here? If there isn't a place, how do we find a place for the kids?
Exactly.
I don't know. Want to continue?
If you can't find answers, you know, when I was talking about my experiences as a young kid growing up, young child growing up, luckily I had assistance in guiding me to some of those answers, some teachers in some respects, some of my extended family members that Yvonne mentioned that, you know, when you start talking about that, I didn't know anything about that term either,
yeah,
but I knew that
grandma,
there were people,
right?
Yeah, there were people who were concerned, and I asked questions consistently, you know, I wanted to know why. Today, we have youth in our communities asking the same questions. We are omitting a lot of valuable information from reaching their consciousness. So therefore, they're turning to some real scary alternatives. At the top of the discussion, you talked about the desecration of the Jewish synagogue in Anchorage, for an instance. Those two young teenagers I followed the story and had some dialogue with a member of the Justice Department from Seattle, Washington, about that incident. Those two youth had basically picked up some literature from a skinhead organization that pushed them to believe that this is the right behavior for me. Now, they didn't have all the answers. They didn't know all that there was or should be known about the skinhead organization. But they felt it was okay. It was cool. So they broke in, and they did what they thought was right and acceptable. It was not, and it is not. It is not acceptable, and to me, and I hope to our greater society, for that type of behavior to exist and for that type of racial hatred to exist in our communities. But if we don't give answers and if we don't start including valuable information about others, then we're leaving the door open for negativism to enter and become more attractive than the truth. You know, and I think a lie has always been, to me, more attractive. I shouldn't say that. Let me clarify that. You know what I mean, you know?
No, I'm sorry, Charles.
People are more susceptible to believing a lie than the truth.
What Beth was saying a bit earlier about platitudes is we want to believe the simple answer.
Right. Yeah.
I dare say about the skinheads and the runaways, what those boys did at the temple was socially acceptable to the group of people who accepted them.
Right.
So therefore it became acceptable to them.
Right. To them.
What a loss. Waukee, I see you thinking and taking notes. Have you thoughts here? Waukee Charles?
No, he says
There's just so much to share, so much to, but so little time. And I'm going, and I'm not, I'm just lost, really, actually, because there's so much.
Yeah.
I'm drowning all
yep.
this stuff because
yeah.
there's. We only have a few minutes,
yeah.
and I have lots to share. I'm going back to my own personal upbringing, I guess, being Alaskan Native, being Yupik Eskimo, and now dealing in a different society, different from my own upbringing, being Yupik and speaking Yupik as my first and only language, and finding out earlier in life that I, in order to survive in the future, I would have to face challenges. I would have to accept the fact that, you know, there are some differences out there in the world. And the only way that I would have to do it is if I force myself, first of all, accepting the fact that who I am accepting the fact that I am who I am and that I can make changes if I may through my own choices. And like Beth was saying earlier, because of great parents, I have found the avenue in pursuing whom I've become. And it was very, very difficult having to speak only Yupik Eskimo, my mother only speaking that language, which made it even more difficult for me to learn English as a second language, and striving only to maybe prove that I, a Yupik Eskimo, Alaska Native, can pursue a professional position just like anybody else. And it was very, very difficult. And there were times when I felt like, well, what am I doing here? Why am I doing this? I should be home, you know, being with my family, with my people, and collecting and storing and sharing and giving. But I felt that, you know, this is not the way it's going to be for the rest of our lives. There needs to be a change. And if that change needs to be done, it's got to happen now. And someone has to do it. And I'm really proud to have made that choice, that decision, that direction to where, you know, it may be just only me doing what I'm doing now. But at least someone from my people have done it to where they say, oh, Waukee can do it. If Waukee can do it, so can I.
And not lose your cultural identity. You didn't give up your cultural identity.
No. In fact, in my classroom, you know, I will use it. I will use my cultural identity. And my kids will see that, you know, not that they say, oh, he's Yupik Eskimo, and he's doing this and he's doing that. No, like picking up after your meals. Lunchtime, this is really, really neat. I have my kids, I start counting down from 10 to 0. And during that time, everybody's on their hands and knees. And the reason why I tell them right before they do it is, you respect the floor by picking up right after lunch. Because when it's time for you to roll on the floor will respect you.
Cute, but it works, huh?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Waukee Charles. We're a little bit after 1 o'clock for people who have tuned in precisely to hear the opera. You are not. You're hearing the end of conversations. The opera will come, and it is the scheduled opera, although I'm nowhere near our schedule, so frankly, I don't know, but you know, so it's all right. This is KUAC-FM in Fairbanks. I'm Susan McInnes. The opera is coming up. But first, we're going to finish a discussion with Sam Dementev and Charles Moore and Beth Horikawa and Waukee Charles and Yvonne Ryans and Kathy Mosley. This is the beginning of a week-long discussion by KUAC and National Public Radio called The Prejudice Puzzle. NPR will be looking at prejudice from all sorts of perspectives, prejudice regarding sexual orientation, prejudice regarding race, prejudice regarding size of individuals. Listen all week long during morning edition, All Things Considered, and weekend edition, and join us on KUAC for news reports on racism in Fairbanks at 6:30, 8 o'clock, 11:55, and 5:30. There's a good chance that someone will repeat those times a little later so you can hear them. Sam Dementev, I wonder if you will continue thoughts that Waukee started, and Charles and Yvonne before him, on becoming the Sam Dementev that you are today. You were raised in Village, went to mission school, and also went to school in Fairbanks, some of which can't have been easy.
Yeah, I remember when I was growing up in a Catholic school at Holy Cross and the Catholic school here in Fairbanks and then in Copper Valley School. But one of the things that I remember was, you know, you develop when you're a kid and you're growing up, you develop this, you know, this question in your mind, well, who am I? I think that comes around in your early teens and is there until you answer that question, if you try to find out who you are. And I think that a good example of this that I read in Life magazine was the Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Originally, his name was
Lew
Alcindor. Yeah.
Basketball. Yeah. Rise up.
Yeah. And he was, I think, was 15 or 16 years old. He had this, it was written up, he had this real question about who he is. And he was an exceptional person because of his height and because of what his abilities. But he went back to Africa and looked up his roots, his family. And after that, the write-ups about him changed. He even changed his name. He said, and he found who he was. And I think that after that, it developed. That's the person that we see today is Lew Alcindor or Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who is a real successful basketball star we all know. But I think that that answering that question, my advice to kids today is not to put so much faith or credence in first impressions. You know, when I walked to this room here, I could see all the people sitting here. I had first impressions. And now that I just, you know, learned who these people are and Waukee Charles, you know, I have real super pride in Yupik Eskimo people, and especially in Waukee. If he can speak his language, I have admiration for him. But if you walked in, and if I just seen who they are, I don't know who they are. My first impressions are wrong. But I had this real impression of different people. But now I have a different impression. I learned who they are, and I took the time to understand them. And I think that kids need to do that. You know, they walk in, and if they're well-dressed, you know, and nice-looking, and they're accepted. Mm-hmm. And they could be turned out to be the worst kids there in the school, in the class, but you find the people who they really are. And I think that's what each one of us need to do. Kids need to find out who they are. What that develops is it develops your self-esteem. It develops pride in self. And I could hear pride in self from Waukee Charles. I mean, he really believes and he understands who he is. And when people do that, I have a great respect for them. And I think that's important, is being able to respect people for who and what they are. And you can see impressions on people that are handicapped or don't look right or don't look good or you know, their color, their skin color is different, or just how they dress. So these, my advice to kids is to watch those things. Be aware that people are real people. You have to find them inside that person. If we all closed our eyes at this moment and heard our voices, and if we didn't see into each other, we walked in this room, it was dark, we wouldn't have any idea, but we'd understand there's a person there until they turn the lights on. All of a sudden we get these impressions, you know. And the way I would see myself is, you know, I went through this questioning part about who I am myself. And I went back and to find out who the Dementevs are. And today, you know, I really feel good. I feel special in being an Alaska Native. I have a real pride and a super pride about myself and about Alaska Native people. People who lived in this land for thousands of years, respected it, and was able to live in harmony with nature and keep it going. Respect. And so those are just a couple of comments about growing up and being able to develop self-esteem, pride in self, and who you are.
Thanks. Sam Dementev, Yvonne Ryans.
I have just a thought that there's a large celebration going out about Ellis Island. You know, it's the museum, and it's wonderful. And I'd like to stop and ask people to think about, and I saw I almost bought the magazine, and I think it's either on the cover of Life or Look, and then I said, no way, I'm not buying it. But what the media does is to giving us a sense of self, because I really question how many people of color came through Ellis Island, how many American mm-hmm. Indians came through Ellis Island, yet we're supposed to look at Ellis Island as this wonderful museum and a place where, after all, we have some origins and the students that can go back and trace to that. Does that make them any better than the Portuguese or the African Americans mm-hmm. who did not come to America via Ellis Island but are here and doing well? So I question the media and how they help kids look at themselves and become who they are.
I'm pausing because the question I had to take over to this side of the room from Sam was, when the media gives us Oh, I don't know whether it's the media. I mean, we blame everything on the media. But we are so tempted in this society at this time to make up our minds immediately with their 30-second television commercials, 10-second television commercials. We get information very fast, and we're asked to make our minds up immediately about something. How do we retrain ourselves to what this clearly very intelligent man has said, which is to take your time, look closely, engage yourself and those around you, rather than making those quick impressions? I don't want to take it away from your thought about Ellis Island, because I think that's same thing. Kathy Mosley?
Let you be quiet here for a minute.
You have to constantly work at changing yourself. Change is the hardest thing to do. Mm. And until you make that part of your everyday existence, you can't change what you are inside. You know, what you were trained to be. And when you get up in the morning, you say, you know, today I will change this. And you do it every day. And I think for kids, you know, not to react initially, you know, no, step back and say, you know, especially from high school, mm-hmm. I'm going to fight that person. Well, no. Let's look at it from a different aspect. You know, no, they wronged me. No, he says, she says, is the worst thing that goes on at Lathrop High School. You know, we've got to get away from that. Go and find out the truth first. Go out and find the real facts. Go to that person who supposedly said this about someone, on and on. Go and see if it's true. And then if it is true, then still step back and say, well, why did they say that? You know, get down to the bottom of things before you strike out. You know, a lot of these kids are very angry. And that's the first reaction.
Beth Horikawa, last thought. I think we're about at the end of our hour.
I just, what Yvonne said really brought to mind something that I find real interesting as a teacher of English. This whole thing about the media and the source of most of our print information in this country and visual information. The mainstream sources of information in this country, for the most part, perpetuate the platitudes. And I know that for most of the information that I've wanted, I've had to go to alternative presses. For example, I was in a class this summer where one of the books that some of us teachers decided we wanted to use, both in the district and at Monroe, was a book by a Hispanic male named Bless Me Ultima. It's put out by a very tiny press, and it's very hard to get. None of the bigger presses wanted to touch it. Now, if I want real information about the Middle East, I listen to the McNeil-Lehrer Report at 10 o'clock. I read the New York Times. Mainstream media in this country do not...